People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Time and again, it's been proven that when affordable housing is accompanied by high-quality education and after-school enrichment, results are significant. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing, we will share a panel discussion that launched Affordable Housing Week in Santa Clara County. Eden Housing co-hosted the Housing and Education Policy Discussion Panel, along with Microsoft and Housing Trust Silicon Valley. Eden's president, Linda Mandolini, and Microsoft's government affairs manager, Jonathan Noble, welcomed attendees at Microsoft's Sunnyvale campus. UC Berkeley's Center for Cities and Schools executive director and founder, Dr. Deborah McCoy, gave the keynote address. And the panel was hosted by Muhammad Chaudhry, Silicon Valley Education Foundation president and CEO, and Eden Housing board member. The panel featured Chris Funk, superintendent of the Eastside Union High School, Jennifer Peck, executive director of the Partnership for Children and Youth, and Sunny McPeak, executive director of the California Emerging Technology Fund, as well as Eden Housing president Linda Mandolini. We hope you enjoy this discussion. There will be more to come in the future.
Good morning, everybody. I really appreciate everybody coming to the policy breakfast. My name is Linda Mandolini. I'm the president of Eden Housing. I am also a founding board member of the Housing Trust of Silicon Valley. And when Kevin Zwick, the executive director of the trust, asked me if I had any ideas for the policy breakfast, I said, well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about housing and education. I don't know if anybody has been following the news, but there are over 1.5 million children in the school system who are homeless. And a couple of months ago, maybe last year, the Mercury News ran this article about the 22 bus that runs up and down El Camino. And in that article, they featured a family, a father and his daughter, who were riding the bus every day. And the reason they ride that bus is because it's the 24-hour bus. And it was the only place they could afford to live. And they were talking about the little girl doing her homework on that bus. And I started thinking, wow, I hope she gets to college, because she's doing her homework on a bus, and she's riding a bus every day, and that's where she lives. And so I couldn't help but think, wow, I wonder how the schools feel about this and having these kids who don't have a place to live. And so I suggested to Kevin that maybe for once, instead of us talking as housing and as schools, maybe we'd start a conversation about housing and schools together. And I have a brand new board member, Muhammad Chaudhry, who is the CEO of the Silicon Valley Education Foundation. He started on my board, what, 60 days ago, Muhammad? That was probably his lucky day, because I'm like, guess what? I have this great idea, and will you do this with me? And so he actually graciously volunteered to join us. And then we are in a place that I think cares a lot about education. So we're very excited that Microsoft is hosting us today, because I think from what I've read of the Gates Foundation, that something they're spending a lot of time on is both homelessness and education. And so I think that this is a really good venue to start this conversation. I promise you this is the first conversation, because when Chris Funk, we asked Chris Funk from Eastside Union to be on this panel, and he said, I know nothing about housing. I was like, well, we're even. I know just about as much about education. So I do think it's the start of a conversation. We're really excited that we can launch a conversation like this, because we think it's critically important. I would love for Jonathan Noble from Microsoft to say a few words and a welcome. So.
Welcome to Microsoft Silicon Valley. This is one of three campuses we have down here in the South Bay. Over 2,500 employees here in the Bay Area. Many of us, you know, prior to joining Microsoft, I had no idea that Microsoft was that big in the Valley. We've actually been here for about 81, thank you, since 1981. It's been a great investment for us in terms of being here in the Valley. We have core engineering, Bing, Hotmail, Xbox, Silicon, et cetera, all based here. Hardcore engineering, a lot of research for us, really tapping into the talent, which kind of gets into some of the topics we're going to talk about today in terms of the importance of education. There is no question that for the generations who are coming, education is really their key, driving up that ladder and making that ladder effective. what we have seen in affordable housing, in fact, all housing, it really is about that nexus between having a good, safe place to live and access to quality education. And that's something that conversations like this are really important to encourage, foster, and grow. And one of the things that I've seen in my years in the Valley, by the way, prior to joining Microsoft, I worked for Charities Housing, a nonprofit affordable housing developer here in the Valley. So this is a conversation in a topic that is very close to near and dear for my heart. And one of the other things I just want to touch upon in terms of hosting these types of conversations, Microsoft hosts over 100 community events a year to foster exactly these type of conversations. Yesterday, at our Mountain View campus, we had over 300 people joining us in conversations around the business climate with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, Mayor Sam Liccardo, Mayor Libby Schaaf, and other leaders who have definitely been playing a big role on housing, talking about how important this issue is. So whether it's affordable housing and education, whether it's housing across the board, transportation, these are all key issues that we have to care about as a community, and we do care about as a community. And it's so fantastic to see you all here this morning to engage in this important conversation. So once again, welcome to Microsoft Silicon Valley, and thank you very much.
So one of the things I thought would be useful for all of us, since there is actually at the national level a lot of conversation going on about place and schools, and I think that that and educational outcomes for children, and should children live in high-income school districts or low-income school districts, and where should the house be in relation to where the school is, and how do you deal with the fact that there are all these underperforming schools and a lot of poor kids go to them? What are the solutions? And a friend of mine, Carol Galante, who's now at the University of California, Berkeley, I called her up and I said, who do I get to talk about the issue and frame it for us? And she said, oh, you have to get Deb McCoy. So Deb McCoy is the founder of the UC Berkeley Center for Cities and Schools at the Institute of Urban and Regional Development at the University of California at Berkeley. That's a long mouthful. And she has actually done a lot of work in this topic, which she told me is becoming increasingly exciting to a lot of folks in policymaking. And so with that, I'm going to give it to Deb. She's going to frame the issue, and then we're going to have a panel discussion about it. So
great.
Thank you.
Am I on?
You're on.
I'm on. Okay, great. It's a little sweet. Hi, thank you so much for inviting me. It's as many people and shared just before me. It's unexpected how many of us have some type of connection between house and the places, homes and places that we live, and housing and education. Personally, I got into education through housing. I was actually a proud bureaucrat before being an academic. I was in New York City, born and bred New Yorker, and I was at NYCHA, not a place many people know out here, but it's huge, the New York City Housing Authority. And I was there for 5 years under two previous administrations. And my job is really to help look at the soft side. We talk about the hard side of housing, but to look at the quality of life. And so education was kind of a no-brainer about the importance of improving the quality of life in public housing. But guess who has never read any of the conversations in any of our policy conversations about improving quality of life? Well, it was housing, schools, right? The local schools were never, ever at any of the conversation. And it was like this, you know, this firewall in tech terms between the housing community development world, which would talk about health and other parts of life, but never about schools. So fast forward 20 years, 10 years ago, I started because, so that was my background, really trying to understand as a practitioner and a kind of a person within a large public housing agency, how do we really think about the trajectory of young people's lives and the critical role that community and supportive communities and particularly housing plays in structuring success for all young people? Because right now, the disconnect, I think, too often structures failure for young people. Right. So the conversation like this is critical to young people in Silicon Valley, across California, and across the nation and globe. It is just really a very key topic. So Linda, you are on the edge of, I think, something that's going to just be changing. I love the private sector, the public sector, and working together on that work. So I love the edge. Great. I don't know how to change the slides up here. Okay. Basic 101. All right, how do I get to, It takes a team. Okay, great. Great. So for my talk today, I have four kind of key points. Someone help give me a 5-minute warning. I want to keep to 20 minutes. We have a terrific panel. I could talk about this for probably a 2-day seminar. So Linda, if you will keep me honest, about 15. Give me a 5-minute warning so I can wind up. Great. Okay. So four key goals that I want to talk about in the next 20 minutes is really kind of a little presenting a little bit of a different frame in how education circles are trying to think differently about educational success, particularly reframing this around the opportunity gap, shifting away from the achievement gap. What are we learning from research? I promise to both share share a bit of research so you know that there's actually some empirical findings towards the important intersection, and yet not to bore you all and make it an academic talk, but a few recent studies that could be helpful. Then I want to share some work we're doing at the Center for Cities and Schools. I'll explain a little bit more about our center in a minute. But what are we learning? We kind of are an action research center, so we try to activate the research and the knowledge that we have. So I'll share a framework and then end with some promising practices. And one of our key promising practices that we want to share about what we think is really vital here in Silicon Valley and anywhere else in the country talking about this intersection. So, the Center for Cities and Schools, how many have ever heard of the UC Berkeley Center for Cities and Schools? Oh, a couple. I have an alumni here, which is great, a student. Great. So, the center is interdisciplinary. We are entering our 11th year. It is kind of unique in that it brings together on a university campus the Graduate School of Education and the Department of City and Regional Planning. So, that 10 years ago, people were like, and what are you doing this for? Now, as Linda said, it's really part of a national conversation. Our mission is exactly what the conversation is here today, to really position high-quality education as a critical component to urban and metropolitan vitality, to create the communities and schools we know our kids deserve and all kids deserve, right? I always like to start out saying, when you want to think about the quality of school, think about where you want to send your kid, and then hold that standard for everybody, right? And then we really level the playing field in that way. We're action research. We look at the intersection of a lot of the issues within regions and communities and schools. Housing, as I started out with, is my key thing. I think everything starts from the places young people live and families live and the quality of life there. But we also look critically at the intersections of transportation, school facilities, sustainable regional planning. The regional factors have a huge part within structuring school quality. And then, again, engaging young people. And that's something sort of our signature is about really listening, engaging young people in community development and placemaking. We have two strategies to do this. We call it to activate the research. One is kind of project-based learning for adults, that we are increasingly knowing that this is a problem, this disconnect and lack of understanding is a problem. The trick is, what do you do about it, right? So how do you activate it? So in communities, it's building capacity. Our PLUS Leadership Initiative is project-based learning for adults, superintendent, mayor level, local, lower staff, coming together around specific projects. Affordable housing is a huge one. The Hope SF Initiative, Choice Neighborhoods, that's an example of a federal strategy and a local strategy to really align housing and education policy. We support them through the PLUS Initiative in the Bay Area. Y-Plan, as I said, is our way of getting young people engaged in this conversation and hearing their insights, which is really important and humbling. As I said, there's a new framing out there, which I think is a very important way to think about this work and really where your opportunity right now is so tremendous about getting involved in changing the status quo. So the opportunity, have anyone heard about this shift in achievement gap to opportunity gap? Superintendent, I'm glad. Okay, great. So the trick is, when you talk about school and school, particularly low-performing schools, it can paralyze people because the issues are so deep, right? Oh my God, the evidence is horrible. The achievement gap is horrible in our nation. It is an embarrassment. But the challenge is, when you only think about the output, about these test scores that show the problem, it's very hard to address, right? Especially non-educators. You tell a bunch of housers, say, oh, come help, you know, tackle the achievement gap, you don't know where to start, because you're not testing, you're not educators. But if you reframe it around thinking about the inputs, not the outputs of testing, but the inputs about what structures success for young people, what are the conditions that we need for young people to succeed, then that's a conversation we all have a part of, right? Because one of the key conditions is access to high quality and affordable housing. Right. So it's kind of an important shift. Researchers are using this a lot. This is a recent book a few years ago, a collection of different perspectives on the opportunity gap. One of the authors and researchers around the housing school nexus from a critical perspective is Richard Rothstein. And he talks a lot about how two-thirds of educational success can actually be seen from non-school factors, right? And this is very much also aligned to the opportunity gap or opportunities, such as affordable housing, quality housing, child health issues, right? Nutrition. If kids don't have eyeglasses, it's pretty hard for them to do well in school, right? It's kind of intuitive, but I think some of these answers are so intuitive that we don't look at them seriously enough in policymaking. Preschool access and parental involvement is a huge one, and that's where a lot of this data comes from the two-thirds involvement. So again, kind of this important shift as a lens to think about our conversations today. So now that there is this national conversation, more and more research institutes are getting involved in trying to understand what do we really know and what data do we have to kind of put insight, more facts and insight and data behind a lot of the assumptions that we're making. The MacArthur Foundation has been one of the biggest foundations around housing matters, really looking at the intersection of housing and other sectors. And they just funded a great new website called Housing Matters. And what they're doing is trying to make it very accessible. So I'm an advisor on it. It just started. And it's really nice because you can actually go to it and click on, oh, housing matters to education, to healthcare, social services. So it's a very nice accessible website. A couple of the studies that we just had on there that I'll just briefly mention, kind of going over the range of research that we have at this intersection now. This first one on children's problems at home and school reflect quality housing quality. Again, not rocket science, but it's important to have data and kind of insights behind it. Four key outcomes from this study. Poor housing quality has a strong and consistent connection with children's emotional and behavioral problems. Poor housing quality is highly connected with poor school performance among older youth. Again, this is what the study had empirically. Children's emotional and behavioral problems are also connected with persistent housing instability, right? So even if you have access to affordable housing, the job market, and there's so many reasons why families move, right? If you go to a lot of schools in Oakland or other places, half of the students at the beginning of the year won't be there at the end of the year. I defer to the superintendent, but mobility is a huge issue to a lot of the districts throughout the country. Finally, and I think this is an interesting way to think about the impact on parents, the stress of living in unsafe conditions or facing multiple moves led to parental depression and anxiety, which in turn affected the interactions with their children and young people, right? So if we know parental involvement is so important, if you actually can't support your young people, then it directly impacts young people. Another study looking at affordable housing kind of around about the cost of housing, right? Typically, we're talking about 30% being a good percentage of our income, a healthy percentage. I thought this was really interesting that this study was looked specifically about how affordable housing is associated with greater spending on child enrichment and stronger cognitive development. Families who spend 30% of their income household income on rent spend $125 more per year on child enrichment than those who spend only 10%. And then even more interestingly, $75 more than those who devote 50% of their income to rent. So again, it's sort of an interesting thing to think about, the implications on, you know, how do families who are low income, if you know your children may need tutoring, other support services, right? The more you pay on rent, the less you have to pay on supporting your young people and all those after school additional supports that other kids may get. So it's just another interesting thing to think about. So the Century Foundation supports a lot of school integration research. I will say, and hopefully in my comments about some of the challenges in the research out there, is that there are two perspectives. One is mobility-based research about school integration, and the other is more place-based community schools approach. The Century Foundation, and there's a lot of data out there about the importance of mixed-income schools, about diverse schools of school integration. And this was a study that's cited a lot by HUD and others. Housing policy, school policy, the economically integrated housing promotes academic success in Montgomery and Maryland. I mention it because it's a study that comes up time and time again by Heather Schwartz. Basically, she did an interesting study on Montgomery, analyzing a community schools approach with a lot of deep social services and a housing mobility approach using inclusionary zoning practices. So you created diversity, not by busing, which was a way we always thought about it before, but by having mixed income housing. And I think this community is particularly important, this type of a policy, and she demonstrated that the mixed income, by creating, using inclusionary zoning, the outcomes were even better for young people, right? They're both important strategies. Unfortunately, they get pitted against each other, but I think we need to understand the range of resources and the range of policies with housing to impact both school integration and a neighborhood place-based approach. We could talk more about it. I just want to kind of give you a quick overview on some of the thinking right now. Our work at the center is really thinking about what we call opportunity-rich schools and sustainable communities. 5 or 6 years ago, HUD and the Brookings Institute asked us to do kind of a how-to guide, like, okay, if we have all this information, what do we do about it? So building a lot of research, such as that I just mentioned, we came up with the 7 steps to connecting opportunity to connecting high opportunity schools and sustainable communities. Now, this was right before everyone started talking about collective impact. There's a lot of new work out there that's wonderful. This is certainly aligned to the collective impact studies out there and work and frameworks. We basically look at the challenges, which are important to think about in moving forward, and then I'll present a 7-point framework that might help your thinking moving forward. And I mentioned the challenges because anybody you go to who's tried to do community development in schools has some type of a horror story about it. Oh, the school wouldn't talk to me, you know, I had this great idea, I had this money, they didn't want it, or vice versa. So there's a history that needs to be acknowledged in connecting community development, housing, and schools. You can get over it, but it's important to recognize it. Resource inequalities, the rigid silos. I'm in higher ed. We rarely train urban planners to understand schools. Similarly, principals are rarely taught how to work with a housing community, right? So there's just this very separate practice that's developed among our professions and silos. Jurisdictional differences. There are sometimes, like in San Francisco, one school district, one city, and even one county. But that's certainly that's the exception, not the rule. I'm sure our local superintendent can talk about that as well. It makes planners bonkers trying to understand the alignment between school districts and school attendance policies and housing, community development, city boundaries. Limited capacity, because we don't train people to work together and integrate. And then, as I mentioned, differences in strategies. Some people in the country are incredibly strong about the mobility strategy, vouchers, inclusionary zoning, move the kids to where the good schools are, where the jobs are. Other equally passionate folks are about, no, it's all about bringing the services to where the kids are. Personally, we need them both. Local context calls for different strategies, so we really have to look at both of strategies. We don't have time to go into this in depth, and it's all online if you're interested in more about our framework. You know, and again, I think it's fairly intuitive. The first step is, and I would say this is a key thing, and again, don't make any assumptions about what's happening in your school. Policies and reforms change so quickly that when a housing community wants to partner with schools, thank you, it's really important to know the landscape and come with a sense of humility about what's happening, because schools are always under the gun and blamed for a lot of what happens in with young people. So, and I say the same thing to schools, go approach the housing community with humility and questions rather than answers to start with. Then, of course, do integrated planning. I want to conclude with how young people are critical to the planning process, implementation, which I'll touch on quickly in a minute, and then sustain the work and institutionalize the work. So steps 4, 5, and 6 are really about the infrastructure and the connection of what you all work in for support the whole life of learners. I know Jennifer and our panel will probably talk about the importance of social services and wraparound services and after-school programming. Promise Neighborhoods, Linda, you asked, that's an example, right? Promise Neighborhoods was lifted up by the president. It's a collaborative strategy in Harlem that's now been modeled in, I think, over 40 communities across the country with mixed success. But a lot of good success too. Align bricks and mortar investment. This isn't just housing development. It's think about school structures, school infrastructure as a part of when you think about a new community, that school facilities is an enormous opportunity, an untapped opportunity in community development. And 6, and I was so glad you started with a transportation point, Linda, because one of the greatest things that we never talk about in education is access to transportation. Right? You can't talk about choice strategies or access to these great programs unless you can actually get there without a car, hopefully, if we think about a sustainable future. So those are the 3 things that housing, transportation, and services that are all critical to the work moving forward. Again, I just mentioned the social services, step 4, such as Promise Neighborhoods, align bricks and mortar investment. We think of schools as opportunity-rich communities, family-oriented, mixed-income housing, and pursue joint development with schools and districts. And I'm not sure this, again, I'm deferring a lot to the superintendent, but we really try to think about the bricks and mortar side from the school side as well as the school side, and then site schools to maximize multimodal transportation access to achieve a lot of our sustainability goals. In Emeryville, there's a new school being developed about schools as a center of community, which is really interesting. Transportation options, again, multimodal, really thinking about pedestrian and bicycle safety. Walkable schools are great if they're safe enough to do it, right? So really think about that transportation. A lot of great outcomes happen when kids can walk to schools with a family if it's safe enough to do that. So I want to conclude. So Linda said, if you had your wish list of what you would suggest both in Silicon Valley and across California, what is the one big thing and message you'd like to end with? And I would say one of our biggest insights after 10 years and 20 years of doing this intersection is when you get young people engaged in a conversation between education and community development, the conversation changes. It changes to how are we all going to work together around young people versus turf and territory and jobs. Right? So if we can focus everybody around young people, it's all around positive. I've been in the most crabby housing community meetings that just everyone is fighting about washers or dryers or something, right? And then you bring young people in and all of a sudden adults start acting more like adults around the kids, right? I'll tell you, I'm sure you've all been to community meetings that get a little raucous, right? Getting kids engaged. What? Are you serious? I am so... Right? Welcome to my life. I get so excited about this stuff. So I'm going to go back for a minute. I'm sorry. That's probably why people were like confused. Okay. So you know what? It's happening automatically. It's something happened. It's stuck. So that's why. It wasn't me. Anyway, so Y-Plan is an educational strategy that turns schools inside out. Currently, over 1,200 young people are going through this Y-Plan educational strategy in 9 cities. 4 of the cities are here in the Bay Area. China, Beijing, and Shanghai, and Japan are also adopting the Y-Plan methodology to engage young people in issues of community development, particularly climate change. Engaging young people is critical. We can do it. It's a great way to partner with schools. An example, so two of the key things here in, obviously, Silicon Valley, to do this type of partnership well, it's about using technology. Right? It's about using technology to create networks among young people, both in school and outside of school. Any way to slow this down? I'm not doing it.
That's a 5-minute warning call.
Okay. There you go. Okay, so I'm going to conclude because I might just run through without me. So obviously technology is necessary to connect the young people, connect curriculum in places. Also, I don't know if you know, but for the first time, school funding finance has really changed, LCFF, local control funding formula. It creates opportunity for far more engagement with local schools and communities. So there's a statewide policy opportunity here in California as well. Example, in the Bayview, elementary school students are involved in choice neighborhoods redevelopment. It is so cool to see third and fourth graders. I'm not touching this. All right. In the Bayview, engage with architects, the National Organization of Minority Architects, who comes in and mentors the kids. Woo, this is going fast. On their ideas for the redevelopment of the Bayview. All right. So there are lots of great ways. The website, we have a website. I have some cards here for our website if you're interested. Take it. There's a lot of public resources about connecting cities and schools. We work with districts and communities to do this work. And I'm going to say thank you. And you've seen this about 10 times. So thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to get started. But once everyone gets their coffee, so this is going to be really exciting. So you really don't need it, but get it anyways.
And not fall off.
There you go.
Try not to fall off the stools. That's the lesson.
Yes. We're still the coffee.
So we've got a great panel, but before we get into the panel, we just want to know who's in the audience. Any policymakers in the audience? Raise your hand. Anyone who works in housing? Anyone working in education? Oh, we got, okay, a handful. Anyone work in the after-school space? Okay, over here, over there. Great. So,
and Julia Miller is a former policymaker. She's trying to hide.
Okay, there we go. We've got former policymakers as well, and which behooves me to recognize Linda and my boss, John Gaffney's here as well, are the chair of the Eden Housing Board. If I get out of line, you're really in charge here. With that, we want to make sure this conversation goes beyond this room. So go ahead and pull out your phones, your smartphones. Take a selfie with the person next to you. Go ahead and do it. It's okay. You guys, panelists, you guys can do it as well.
So
take a selfie.
Oh,
you guys can bring your phone. Okay.
Bad etiquette on the panel.
Somebody take a picture of us.
And I'll tweet this when I'm done.
Please. You have to do it. Thank you.
Okay. Sunny. We're all going to participate here. I'll take a picture of you, Sunny. You are used to being an elected official. Here we go. Here's our selfie right here. Here's our selfie right there. There we go.
Right, we got it.
At Housing Trust SV.
So it's a Housing Trust SV at Eden Housing, and the hashtag is Policy Breakfast. So please extend the conversation, because we have so many folks who are going to say lots of great things. They've got a great picture there they're smiling at. So I think we have success.
Perfect. NPH is tweeting us immediately.
There we go. There you go. There you go. Okay, so the conversation today is really going to be around how do we... Okay, I'm going to... Chris, you're going to have to help. The teacher is going to have to help make sure we bring the conversation back here and get people off the phones now just for a second. That may not have been a good practice on my part. So today's conversation is really going to be around a couple of things. One is the idea of how do we make new money glue money? How do we glue some of these great resources together? The second idea is really around, there's a great guy named Leo Chavez who used to work in the education space in the Valley. He told me a story that in the 50s, you know, the churches and the mosques and synagogues took care of moral training. There was always one parent at home that took care of teaching kids how to tie their shoes and do all those things. So all the schools had to worry about was the education part. Fast forward, for whatever reason, schools have a huge portfolio in the 6 hours that they have the kids for, and they just can't do it all. Now, that applies to every child, and it's not a value statement, it's just a matter of fact that the schools are having to take on roles outside of pure education. So today's panel covers a lot more. I believe today's panel actually covers a 24-hour day in a child. We've got Chris Funk, who covers that 6 hour during the school day. We've got Jennifer Peck, who covers the after school portion. Then we've got Eden Housing, who covers the night and morning. And then we've got Sunny and others who through technology, they actually touch all parts of those days, hopefully, including the school day in terms of engaging with students and families. So what we're going to do today is each panelist is going to speak for what we're hoping for is 5 minutes. I'll be the bad person who will cut everyone off at 5 minutes, and that's only to make sure that we have a conversation with the audience afterwards as well. And I'm going to now introduce our great panelists who've been very patient. First, to my left is Sunny McPeak, who's the president and CEO of the California Emerging Technology Fund. Sunny, a statewide nonprofit organization whose mission is to close the digital divide by accelerating the deployment and adoption of broadband. Please give Sunny a hand. And next we have Linda Mandolini, Linda is the president of Eden Housing, one of California's oldest nonprofit affordable housing developers. She oversees affordable housing production, resident support services, and property management component of Eden Housing. Give Linda a hand.
We already introduced Deb.
We already got Deb, so we're going to go to Jennifer. And Jennifer is my boss on another board. I've got lots of bosses here. This is going to be a hard job here. Jennifer is the executive director of Partnership for Children and Youth. The Partnership for Children and Youth was created in 2003, and Jennifer is the organization's first executive director. During her tenure, she has developed and implemented initiatives to finance and build after-school and summer learning programs and increase access to school meals and nutrition education programs in the state's lowest-income communities. Jennifer Peck. And at the end, you play basketball professionally, I hear, and you've got this superintendent gig that I'll talk about right now.
I am one of your bosses.
Yes.
which I was going to get to next. Chris is the superintendent of Eastside Union High School District, the second largest high school district in California. And again, he's one of my bosses. I serve at his mercy on many events, including this panel. Chris, let me tell you a little bit more about Chris. Chris grew up in the Rose Garden area of San Jose, received his master's in social science from San Jose State University in 1991. You look a lot younger, Chris, but that doesn't seem like that long ago. He's a product of San Jose Unified School District, graduating from Lincoln High School in 1985, where he had the good fortune and great honor to return as principal. And then he served in Eastside Union High School District and now the superintendent of Eastside Union High School District. Please give him a hand. So now we're going to go into this fast-moving, 5 minutes each, on open presentations on context from their organization. How do we connect housing with other elements of a student and a family's life? We'll start with Linda. Linda?
Yeah, thank you.
And Linda, you have some slides?
I have slides, but okay. You know, they're all pictures, and I promise I'll go fast. And okay. I actually am not going to wonk about this. I'm just going to talk about why this matters to me and why it matters to Eden. So. This is the house I grew up in. It's 1,150 square feet. It's three bedrooms. It's one bathroom. It is in a town that my parents saved and saved and saved and saved by. I am the child of Italian, product of Italian immigrants. My father had one issue for all of his kids. We were going to go to college. We were broke. My parents to this day qualify for every program that I have worked in at Eden Housing. And all he cared about was us going to college. They saved every penny they had to buy this house in this school district, because they knew that if we went there, we might have a chance to go to college. So this is all four of us graduating from college. Yes.
Yes.
But as Deb mentioned, it took a lot for us to get there, right? It took parents. It took our church. It took our access to a good school. It took people paying a lot of attention to us being successful. And so it is graduation season. My nephew is graduating from college on Sunday. It wasn't a question of if he would graduate from college. It was a question of where would he go. So we have had huge generational success. You know, I love graduation week. This is Eden Palms here in San Jose. This is a project where I met John Gaffney, who was on leave from Cisco as a Digital Connectors Fellow with us, a Cisco Fellow. And this was the first place that we had a computer room. In 1996, we built a computer room because only 12% of the families who lived at Eden Housing actually could afford a computer in their home. That number is 50% today. That project opened the year I moved to California, 1996. It was the first one I saw at Eden Housing. And I met this family, the Nguyen family. They were recently immigrated from Vietnam. They had five kids. And you know, last year when everybody's posting up pictures of their children graduating from college, I don't have my own children, so I don't have children to post. But I had this picture of Cy Nguyen graduating from medical school with his mom. Cy grew up with us at Eden Housing. He moved there in 96. He participated in our after-school programs. He was our first digital connector, which was an experimental program we ran on technology with teens. We had 700 kids in that program, but he was one of the first five. All of his brothers and sisters have also been in the program. His younger brother is a double major at Columbia. This is why this matters. And that's why we're here. That's why I want to have this conversation, because they are the demographic that I'm sure Chris is serving in the Eastside Union High School. They are the demographic that I grew up with. They are the demographic that we are trying to help. And if we don't give these kids a chance and access, they will not be successful. So that's my intro. Did I meet my 5 minutes?
Wow, you did. It's, wow, you hit 3 minutes. Chris, you don't get the additional two.
Well, you know, Mohammed, this is because I go to city council hearings a lot, and I'm on a buzzer all the time. So I'm practiced at 3 minutes.
Next, we have Chris, the superintendent of Eastside Union High School District.
Well, thank you. And let me start by clarifying two things. One, Mohammed said that he wasn't making a value statement. I will make the value statement.
And,
when we are the 49th or 48th state that in the level of funding for education, that's a value of whether we value education. Just in California, when you have public schools that have two different ways of funding education, if you're a basic aid district, that many are right here in San Mateo County, you receive approximately $14,000 per student per ADA. But when you are a revenue limit or now an LCFF and you receive $8,200 per student per ADA, We have, that's a value statement right here in California. When we have families that choose, and I support their choice to send their school, their children to private schools, Bellarmine, Presentation, what have you, $20,000 a year to go there. I hope they're not just sending their children there for to move away from public schools, but they're sending their child there to receive a certain type of education, to receive a certain type of facility, $20,000 per child to educate. That's a value statement. So until we truly value funding public education, we will continue to have not only the achievement gap, but the opportunity gap, which I appreciate Deb talking about, because we've been talking about the opportunity gap when I was with San Jose Unified 5 years ago as they started their strategic plan. And now in Eastside, it's a cornerstone of our strategic plan. Because when you talk about the opportunity gap in education, there are so many factors that we cannot control, but yet we're asked to try to deal with. And that's the opportunity gap for great schools, great teachers, access to top courses, AP courses, international baccalaureate courses. But it's also about access to healthcare, access to housing, access to technology, access to jobs. When you just look at the input of the, or the output, excuse me, of just state testing, you can just look within Eastside at one school, Andrew Hill, where the highest performing ethnic group is our Vietnamese students, but just a few miles down the road, Silver Creek High School, high performing school, the lowest performing group of Latinos outperform the highest group of Vietnamese at Andrew Hill. So it's not about ethnicity, it's truly about your zip code, and it's truly about jobs, and it's truly about housing, it's truly about the opportunity gap for our kids to be successful. I digress. Let me go a little bit about who we're talking about on the East Side. We're talking about foster youth, and we're talking about kids that are homeless that qualify for the McKinney-Vento program. So it's really students that are out of home placements, whether they're in group homes, they're in foster care, they're living with relatives. These are students that are supervised by child welfare or probation agencies. We have approximately 90 students in Eastside. One of the problems with our foster care is that there is not a single database throughout California that's truly underrepresentative of the kids that are within our system, because they don't communicate with social services, with all the different educational systems. Eastside is a high school district with 7 feeder districts representing almost 85,000 students, but yet the ability to communicate with each other is extremely tough. When you look at the McKinney-Vento Act, these are students that are homeless, and they could be homeless with their families too, who lack a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. Okay, and these are families, children that are living in motels, they're living in hotels, they're living on a bus line, campgrounds, transitional shelters, cars. We have 165 identified students that fall under the McKinney-Vento, way underrepresentative.
More partnership
For Eastside. And again, that's a policy issue that we need to do a better job statewide being able to identify who our homeless students are. So what we try to do to the best of our ability is to provide the support systems for our students that fall under foster care or the McKinney-Vento, which really are one of the same group of students in many cases. And so we offer online course recovery through Cyber High. We make sure that we work with our counselors to those students that qualify for college, that we give them the financial ability to do that through the FAFSA application process, and there are many summer school opportunities. One of the things that we've done with the local control funding formula, the new formula that the governor has created to fund schools, this year was our first year implementing it. We hired a full-time social worker at every single high school who then supervise anywhere from 2 to 4 interns. This is a critical need because we were in the past having a teacher on special assignment who had no clinical training in social work or in child psychology, monitoring our students. So we felt that that was a huge need for us to make sure that we provide the appropriate services for our students. as well as we hired a full-time parent liaison and created parent centers at every single high school. Because as you can imagine, if you are new to the United States and new to public education, coming to our high schools that are as large as 3,100 students at Independence and as small as 1,200 at James Lick, it can be very intimidating coming onto that campus. So our goal with the Parent Center was one-stop shopping. We go to the parent liaison. We hope that that person can answer 85 to 90% of the questions. If they can't, then they can schedule the appointment with the appropriate individuals. So those are two areas that we're looking to support. And you can see that the county is involved, really focusing on our foster youth and our McKinney-Bento students. And then our policy recommendations, we can get more into it, but really we just need to provide the housing as close as possible to students in the system, because this is the fact, the number I want you to take home with you. If a student changes high school more than once, just one time, 50% less likely to graduate from high school.
That's a tweetable fact.
Absolutely. 50% less likely if they just change high schools once. Our kids who are in the foster system or are homeless, they will change up to 8-9 times. We've already created a system for them that they're not going to graduate. They're going to continue to fall in the cycle that they currently live in. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Great.
Hold on to that.
Hold on to it?
You're good. You get to keep that one.
Okay, next we have Jennifer Pett.
Thank you. Let's see if this is going to work. That we're more close. Okay. So I was actually told, Muhammad, I had 10 minutes.
Really?
Since I'm your boss.
Just take it away. It's okay.
This will be, it'll be speed presenting. I'll consolidate. Okay. So my organization does a variety of things to help ensure that kids from very low-income communities can show up at school every day ready to learn and navigate successfully through school into adulthood. But our largest area of focus is around helping our youth-serving institutions to provide really high-quality after-school and summer programming to low-income kids, because we know through a great deal of research and experience that these programs are just a critical ingredient to school success. And I think it's pretty well known at this point, a lot of the research about after-school programs, that kids who participate regularly in a good after-school program are much more likely to show up at school consistently, they have better attendance, they have better grades, and they have better overall engagement in school. So we know that very, very strongly at this point through a lot of research. I would also say that summer arguably is an even more important time for us to be paying attention to.
Clearly call that individual company. This is what you did. This is what you got done. But the data for the
there we go. We have this phenomenon that many of you have probably heard of called summer learning loss, in which kids who are not engaged in some kind of learning and enrichment program over the summer that can reinforce the skills and the habits they learned during the school year is lost over the summertime. And low-income kids can typically lose up to 2 months of both math and reading skills over the summer. And if you look at this graph, this really shows how summer is a significant contributor to the achievement gap between low-income kids and their higher-income peers. And what this graph really shows is that during the school year, all kids are in growth mode. They're learning. They're achieving during the school year. In the summer is where you really see these discrepancies start to happen, and low-income kids really start to fall off. And what's particularly dangerous about summer learning loss is that it's cumulative. So the more summers that kids are falling behind, the more and more likely they become, really, they're never going to catch up. That happens to quite a few kids past the fifth grade, if it's happened every summer up to the fifth grade, and become much more likely to drop out of school. So summer is a place I think we need to be paying particular attention to, where housing organizations have a really potentially exciting role to play. So
again, this isn't meant to be
as an intermediary organization, there's a variety of things that we do to support schools and community organizations of a variety of kinds to build and sustain and really run high-quality after-school and summer programs. It's policy and advocacy. We do a lot of training and technical assistance and capacity-building work, and we do a lot of support with trying to find public and private funding for these dollars. And Until about 4 years ago, we were very, very focused on schools in our work because that's where the vast majority of public funding is going for these kinds of programs and where most of the kids are. And then one fateful night, about 4 years ago, I met Linda Mandolini at a Cowell Foundation retreat, and we got to talking over a glass of wine, and I told her about what my organization did, and she began to tell me about what her organization did, and that she was a housing provider, and they had all these kids in their developments that they were trying to provide youth programs for. But the challenge was they're housing people. They're not educators. They're not youth development experts, and they didn't feel like they were doing enough and that they were providing the kind of high-quality research-based programming that was really going to make a difference for kids in the long term. So she suggested a partnership. And if you know Linda, you know that the conversation did not end there. She was relentless in pursuing the idea of this partnership between us.
I'm not relentless.
I took it to my board, and we had a very rich conversation about this. And pretty quickly, we came to the conclusion that if we weren't working in housing communities, we weren't doing our job in trying to reach the most vulnerable kids with these kinds of services. And that, in fact, wow, what an incredible opportunity we had in front of us, because we have this captive audience of young people of all ages in these housing organizations. And if we could be really intentional, help their staff be really intentional about developing high-quality programming and giving them the tools and the resources they need to run great programs and develop links with schools, then we could make really an enormous difference. And so we set out in a process of adapting the work that we were doing with schools around training and capacity building and resource development to the housing setting. And so we've been doing that for the last 4 years. We've been training staff from housing organizations in how to run high-quality summer and after-school programs, and really thinking more about the link with schools. And there's been so much interest and momentum around this that it turned into what we're now calling House Ed. It is a network that we're convening of housing providers and staff at various levels who are interested in engaging in this work. And the goal is providing a safe, supportive environment where children and youth can learn, lead, and thrive. So I will leave it at that. We are really excited to be working in this space. We think it's got so much potential for growth.
Great.
PowerPoint free, excellent.
Perfect. And next we have Sunny McPeak.
Thank you, Mohammed, and thank you, Linda, for including me in the panel. And Jonathan, I thought your remarks were just wonderful. They were very special, and it reflects everybody in this room. If you're here, you really care. Probably you're here mostly because you're in the housing world, but you understand the connection to education, and no one in affordable housing is there just to provide shelter. It's all about transforming lives. And so while I'm here with the California Emerging Technology Fund, and that's the organization I have, the mission is to close the digital divide. Make no mistake about it that the digital divide is just another manifestation of the economic divide and the opportunity divide. And so I was really struck by your photographs. I grew up on in a small dairy farm in the San Joaquin Valley, and the footprint of the house that we lived in when I was born was 180 square feet. It was two rooms. It was two stories, so 360 square feet. There was actually a third room. We were lucky. It was a bathroom that we had indoor plumbing. My aunt and uncle, a half a mile away, did not. I remember well that proverbial two-seater and all of the smells and all of the cobwebs in it. And this bathroom was so small that the toilet was put in sideways, and that's how we sat on it. And we had to sit on it sideways. I actually didn't know that you sat on it frontways until my mother sent me to Sunday school. And that's how the stalls were. So we all bring to whatever we do those experiences, and my parents, even though those were pretty modest circumstances, said before I went to kindergarten, you have to go to college because that was the way out, that I wasn't going to be stuck on the farm. And so indeed, I was the first in my family to graduate from college, thanks to the taxpayers and the University of California. And it's now 50 years later, and I've been in this work of trying to
close many gaps. And I will tell you that first I was in housing, because housing mattered to my mother, and I was a planning commissioner. I approved housing as a county supervisor. I was sued many times over affordable housing as an elected official. Somehow I'm either on or off, but if I'm off, I will just speak up, because I can do that. Let's try this. Okay, you want to turn me on or off? I don't want to have double feedback. You always turn me on. I would love you to be my boss. Okay, let's just
go. All the time you need.
I need all the time. Okay. The point I want to make is that, and I also was a founding member of the Bridge Housing Board. Oh, my gosh. So you get sued over a lot of good things. You know, no good deed goes unpunished. I had the opportunity to work as Secretary of Transportation, Housing, and Business for the state of California. So know all of the challenges throughout the state, and then I got recruited to do this job of using technology. And all that technology is a tool. It is a tool to empower people, and it is more transforming for folks who are low income than not. We see every day what difference it makes in schools in low income neighborhoods if the kids actually have access to technology, the teachers are trained how to use it well, how to use it in their lesson planning, and the parents get to have that connectivity at home. Now they're actually engaged with the school. So all of these pieces that we talk about in terms of a community are unfortunately siloed in the way government operates. They're siloed in the way that philanthropy operates. And as you said it, I hadn't heard that, but you want the new money to be change money?
To be glue money.
To be glue money, and that is exactly what you in philanthropy should demand. All of you as taxpayers pay a hell of a lot of money to support public services in counties, cities, and schools. All people really dedicated to do their work, and they deal with folks as if they had one problem that was separate from the other, as opposed to not just place-based strategies of mixed income, mixed-use housing, neighborhoods, and supporting schools, but all of those people who work in human services in county land, where I was a county supervisor, be it public health, social services, mental health, drug, alcohol, probation workers, need to be partners with community policing. The cities have all of the municipal policing powers, and everybody held accountable for whether or not kids are learning in Chris's school. The first test of whether or not we're doing our job in the public sector is our kids thriving. They're the canaries in the mine. And that's the glue money can actually be also the money that causes centripetal force, that is the forming of everybody aligning their efforts. So it's before you get to place-based strategies, it needs to be people-focused. Every child and their family needs to thrive. What we found is that technology actually is so helpful in those strategies, those glue strategies, the empowering strategies, and needs to be an integral part of the solutions. And that is what we have been doing with Eden Housing. We're partners, as John knows. I'm an investor. Linda has been a great leader at a national level, getting HUD to now understand if we've got, and we do in California and across the country, 25% of our residents are not online. Literally, a quarter of the population is not connected. Believe that.
39 million people who live here.
And that's exactly right. And 39 million people who live here. What that means for all of us in a technology state in Silicon Valley is that we're leaving behind a quarter of the population at an accelerated rate, that are being disenfranchised even from the democracy. You can't apply for a job unless you do that online. You can't do your homework, I would submit, Chris, if you can't actually navigate the internet. You certainly can't get a good job, and you can't even apply for college. Can't even apply for college if you're not online. And so integrating these strategies is what we are all about. And I think you, as an investor, can be the glue that makes it happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Sammy, we'll transition right on over to some general questions that I have. And then if you have any questions, think of them now. But the rules of these questions are very simple. A, we're not going to admire the problem anymore. We're going to go towards solutions. And B, try to think about solutions in your space, but also suggest others can do to help you. What are policies that other groups on this panel can do to help you achieve your results as well? Sunny, you served at the statewide level as well. What are some policies at the statewide level that can help this divide?
So at the statewide level, it really has to be about, first of all, outcomes and accountability. I mean, that is very much, I had a very large agency, 42,000 employees and 14 departments, and we changed many of those in a very short period of time. What I always wanted in the transportation world, Julia and I served working on transportation, is that it's, again, one of those facets of how do you empower communities, how do you serve communities, and the policy that the state should expect of counties and cities and schools is that we align everything locally around outcomes for families and their children, and that's the glue.
Others on the panel, any policies at the state level that you can think of that could help us here?
I'll throw one out from the area in which we work around the after-school and summer program piece. I think many people probably don't know that California invests more public money in after-school and summer programs than all other states combined. We invest annually $550 million in after-school and summer programming through what was called Proposition 49, which was passed on the ballot back in 2002. So this puts us way ahead of most other states in what we're investing. Those resources have been largely directed at schools, I think very appropriately, because we wanted there to be a strong link between what was happening after school in the summer and during the school day. However, we have a great deal of expertise and infrastructure and resources in the system in California that can be brought to bear in the housing space, and that's what we've been trying to help facilitate in our small way in this region. But there's actual dollars in the system for things like training and technical assistance and convening and sharing of practices, getting housing providers engaged in the many rich opportunities we have around professional development in youth programming. So I think that's a piece I would like to see the state be more proactive around, how to get housing organizations tapped into those dollars and resources.
Chris, Linda, Deborah?
Well, I would just add on to the technology divide. In Eastside, the community just passed Measure I EdTech bond, and one of the major tenets of that bond, we will pay off, every 3 years, we'll pay off the bonds for technology, but the main tenet is that we will provide wireless access to all of our students in Eastside. And we're partnering with the city of San Jose to access their wireless network. So we're going to pilot it at 3 schools over the summer, and by December we hope to have 100% of our schools online through the city wireless accessing our network, so our students have a much better opportunity to research, work on their projects, and there is no reason why every school district cannot work with every city in the state of California to provide wireless,
Chris,
for all of our citizens.
What's the policy every district can use to do that? How did you get the money?
Well, the money was through an EdTech bond.
What is that?
And a bond. So there are two different types of bonds that you can do for a school district. You can do a parcel tax that pays for program and people, or you can do a construction bond that pays for the construction of buildings. And so an EdTech bond falls under the construction bond, and it's just how you allocate that money and how you spend it and pay it off. So it's something that you only need, for a bond, you only need 55%, but for a parcel tax, you need 66.25% to pass. And I think that that type of policy would allow, if we could lower the threshold for parcel taxes down to the simple majority, that would support all schools also for improving the programs that are available.
Right, but Mahabada, at the state level and federal level, very important policy that everybody is shying away from. Nobody is saying, as they're putting up yet another $1 billion is now going through, very important for local control funding formula, implementing Common Core, that it is the policy to ensure that we get a one-to-one ratio and that those are internet-enabled and focusing on the schools and low-income neighborhoods.
So would you say that there should be a statewide policy that
absolutely.
One-to-one?
And not only do I say it, we are testifying, we're advocating it, and I am sorry to say that there is a reluctance to really embrace that.
So what is one-to-one?
It means that every student should have a computing device. And especially at the middle school level and high school, it's the technology is actually amazing at a younger age. At E-rate, so now let's...
What is E-rate? We'll make it a good point, Linda.
You may be aware, if you're in schools, that the Federal Communications Commission collects money off of your landline telephone into something called the Universal Services Fund. It's a $4 billion annual subsidy that's mostly cross reimbursements among the telecom companies. Unbelievable, not much transparency. E-rate was enabling a subsidy to schools and libraries from the 96 Telecom Act. This Federal Communications Commission that sits there today started through modernization of this subsidy last year, and they actually added funding, which is great.
That's great.
What they didn't say is, if we're putting more funding into education, we expect higher returns on that investment, better performance. And they too have not gone to saying, and we understand the 25% of the folks in this country who are not online actually live in low-income neighborhoods, and we need to focus there.
This connects.
So
okay.
That's the kind of policy that is huge, that would make a lot of difference. And notwithstanding the Obama administration going after Connected, they have not yet connected the dots that need to happen in federal policy.
Linda, what about from the housing side? What are some state at the state level, what are some policies?
So I think, for me, really, I think we need to produce more affordable housing. So when we wiped out the redevelopment agencies, we took away two things. We took away a mandate to develop in those redevelopment areas 20% of all the housing as affordable, and we also took away $1 billion of funding a year for affordable housing. So I think this year the state can do two things. They can pass AB 1335 and AB 35, two bills in the legislature to create funding for affordable housing. It's really simple. If you have not signed on to these bills, please do. Please talk to your associations and sign on, because that will create probably $500 million, which is replacing some of what we lost. So we need to build more housing. But we also need to give the localities the ability to have inclusionary ordinances. What Deb talked about in Montgomery County, in California right now, you can only do that in single-family subdivisions. You can, or condos. You cannot have a requirement that market-rate rental housing include affordable apartments. That cost San Jose nearly 1,000 new affordable homes because they couldn't apply it because of a crazy court ruling. So we need to fix that, and I think we need more homes. And so I think that's one thing the state could do. The other thing is, if the school bond measure goes, which it's going to go to the ballot, it should allow for all of this stuff that we're talking about. It should allow us to connect the kids. It should allow us not to just deal with the superstructure of the schools, but also how the kids are connecting to those schools. And I feel like it would be a missed opportunity, and I think they're going to get enough signatures for that bond measure to go, so I think we should do something together on that ballot initiative.
And you want the educators and others to connect on these two bills as well to help support
yes,
this, too.
I think if the educators could help us with that, it would be a group that they, particularly we need three Republican votes, it would be a group that has not been heard from as loudly. And I would say the problem with the state of California is they like to pit us against each other. God forbid we all get in the same room together, we would be their worst nightmare, right? Because they think it's a question of funding us or funding schools. Because they're not looking at the outcomes.
Could you support something like this?
I definitely could support something like this. Remember now, the state bond, though, is a matching bond. You have to have your local community passing a bond so that you can then match those funds. So there's still that challenge of communities passing bonds to access the state money. Yep. But I think connecting it to not only the structure, infrastructure of the school district, but how we connect with students and low-income families in low-income housing is a unique idea.
Okay. And we all are going to sign up to look for three Republicans in the state of California. That's all we need.
After we find them. I can point you to them. They are not from this region. But
So let's go from state to local. What are some local policies at a city level, county level, school district level that can help this work?
So Chris kind of hit on my wish list because you're getting something that we are not getting in San Jose. So John Gaffney, who is on Eden's board, works for Ruckus Wireless, who did the wickedly fast Wi-Fi that's here in San Jose, and you're going to get that in your schools. I would love it if San Jose would make it a policy that we could get wickedly fast Wi-Fi in our housing. Because if the city could do that for all of its affordable housing, we could much more quickly get...
What would it take to do that? What's
you know, I have no idea. I don't know. I think it's a cost question for the cities more than likely, or how would we wire that? We'd have to wire the housing, because for me, about 50% of my families can afford Wi-Fi. And Robert Jones, who's my partner back there in East Palo Alto, I know we work in East Palo Alto and Palo Alto. These school districts, they're 100% online. The school districts that we work with, you cannot see your kids' homework unless you have a smartphone or a connection to a computer. I have kids lining up 10 deep in computer rooms to do their homework because they don't have a computer in their house. I think the cities who are doing all this big Wi-Fi and all the companies that are helping them do it need to help us figure out how we get to the low-income kids' homes.
So why can't we have this wickedly fast wireless in homes?
We actually think you should. So CETF sponsored legislation that actually got passed 2 years ago to start with $25 million in a fund, a subsidy fund for deploying broadband that is administered by the California Public Utilities Commission, and it's to go to publicly subsidized multi-unit, multi-family housing. Okay, so that's the beginning. There are 300,000 units in the state of California that are publicly subsidized, multi-unit, so attached. I will tell you, all of those buildings are different construction, different layouts, and as John will know, then you have to look at property by property. Part of the constraint that an affordable housing organization has or a housing authority is that they already have a budget that was part of their construction, and they didn't put the connectivity in to begin with, and then they have an operating budget. So those are policies that Lynn and I have been working at the federal level and the state level to change. But it should be, from the housing perspective, the state of California, get all of this publicly subsidized housing that is multi-unit, because the predicament for those families are different than elsewhere.
In terms of cost, it doesn't seem like it's a large cost. And philanthropy could cover this.
You know, you absolutely could. And here's what...
It's an ongoing cost.
There is an ongoing cost of the maintenance, which is part of why the maintenance of a what we call an advanced communications network. We're in some of the toughest housing projects in California. We partnered with the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles in two of their toughest projects, Jordan Downs and Mar Vista Gardens. One is 750 units, the other is 601. At night, the computer lab that is in one of those gets taken over by the gangs to run their business. And so the parents need the connectivity in the housing unit for the safety of their kids. The kids can do their homework. We have a target of being able to hit connectivity, and it's a combination of wire line coming across the last foot. I call it the last foot connectivity. It's literally across the property line. And then points of presence with wireless of somewhere between $200 and $300 per unit, right? That's an important number for you to know.
$200 to $300
per unit for the connectivity. It is about $50 a unit going on an ongoing basis if you really want to have the robust system and have it repaired on an annual basis. And then we budget $250 per household to train. We train every resident so that they can actually use the device and get them the device for that $250 per household.
That's yours. And San Francisco just did something around this, the iPad initiative as well. But Jennifer, talk to us about from your perspective. I assume while California is one of the highest funded in after school, there's still more needed. What are some local policies that can happen to help support after school as it relates to this as well? Because most of these kids, I assume, come to you before they go home.
Yeah, well, one thing I wanted to mention that Linda reminded me of when she mentioned homework is that I think one of the barriers to creating and sustaining successful youth programming in housing is the communication disconnect between housing organizations and schools. And I think if we could create some at least better guidance around information sharing about student performance between teachers and schools and housing providers who are running youth programs, it would really go a long way. If folks in the housing organizations are really serious about affecting school performance, making sure kids get to school consistently and on time, want to help them in a targeted way with certain parts of their coursework that they're struggling with, or on certain social and emotional and behavioral challenges, it's really important that they're communicating with the school and the teacher about what is going on with that child. But it gets a little bit tricky with privacy laws around student information, and there are varying interpretations around what the privacy laws actually are telling us to do or not do. And we do have examples of programs out there that are pretty successfully sharing information about student performance within the law. And it's incredibly important in order to target the interventions and to be serving kids well off-site. So those are policies we'd like to see put into place more consistently.
Deborah?
I can use my teacher voice.
Here you go.
Oh, you got a mic. We'll get you a mic.
Really bad. A quick point that part of the connection is the lack of parental understanding of technology. Some of the students in Washington, D.C. who did Y-Plan chose the digital divide as their greatest issue. It wasn't, of course, access to technology. It was affordable bandwidth that they were talking about. They did community surveys about what was the issue, impact on their ability to do well in school. And it wasn't, they're all tech savvy. My 8-year-old knows technology a lot better than, I do. I'm sure a lot of us share that. But their parents didn't know how to use the technology. So even when they got access to an iPad on a rotating basis, it was hard for their parents to know what they were doing, and they thought that they were on the websites or cruising, And so the issue about parent involvement and parent-student capacity building is just something to think about, incentivizing in terms of policy. But the role of parents in the digital divide is huge in our communities.
So before we go forward, we're going to move to a lightning round now. So we're going to look for sound bites. But Linda, then Sunny.
Well, I was just going to say, I think this question of local, it would be just nice as a houser to know the principal in the school district that I work in, and to have the just to be able to cooperate, and to have a city that says we really want you guys to work together. So I'll just use Petaluma as my example. We went to Petaluma 10 years ago to ask them for money to support the Boys and Girls Clubs doing after school in our property, and Petaluma said, "No way. I pay the Boys and Girls Clubs to do that. I paid for your community room. They're going to do their program in your community room. They're going to serve the whole neighborhood." And I said, "Well, that's not quite in the tax credit rules. So we don't care. Come get us." We served 98% of our kids. They are going to places like Columbia for college. We start when they're really young. And it's because we had this connection with the school, the Boys and Girls Clubs, and the home. Mm-hmm. And the broader community. Like, we were a hub. And it's a small enough city that we could really quantify some numbers and make something happen. And I feel like that's a replicable model, and I know that it is. So on the local level, it just would be more of us trying to figure out how we work together, and having more of our funders think about encouraging that to happen. Sort of say, "I'll pay for you to do that, but you're not going to do that over there. You're going to do it over here."
Got it. Yeah. Got it. Great. Sunny, real quick.
I wanted to agree with Deb in the terms of parent engagement. We have run a program, developed it and run it, called School to Home. I mentioned it. It includes 10 components, but part of that is at least 6 hours of training for the parents on the school-issued device, so that when it goes home, the family knows how to check the homework assignments and the grades. Now, here's the compelling evidence that once those parents have actually been trained on the devices, how to use it, even if there's not an affordable rate, and believe me, we are knocking on the doors of all of the regulators, you need to have an affordable lifeline, broadband rate, blah, blah, blah. the adoption rate, i.e. subscription for non-English speaking parents, goes up by more than 50%.
Wow.
Because they were lower to begin with. And for English speaking parents, more than 10%. So the goal of closing both the achievement gap and the digital divide in that school strategy in a low-income neighborhood is effective.
Great. So now we are moving to the lightning round. We have very little time left. We're in the heart of Silicon Valley, guys. What can technology companies do to help? And then don't just think about literally technology, but how can they help this cause? Chris, we'll start with you. Or maybe you give an example of a tech company that is helping. If it's Microsoft, you'll get bonus points.
Well, I just think that we have to solve the digital divide, and there is no reason, Silicon Valley, that we cannot take care of this issue. As I mentioned with the city of San Jose, there are street lights on every corner of a city. Every street light has data access and has power. We're paying to connect to that. The city is allowing us to use their data for free. That's about a $3.5 million investment to connect 24,000 students in Eastside. Then what we're providing for our students is just a little $15 antenna you plug into your outlet to bring that wireless into their house. It's a minimal cost. And then those students that don't bring their own device, we will provide it. But we need technology here in Silicon Valley, all of our corporations, to make sure that we can provide that access, whether it's through in-kind, whether it's through specific donations, or it's working with our cities to connect to each of our schools. It can be done.
Jonathan is listening, right? And he's representing all the technology companies in the Valley right now. Jennifer.
You know, I was going to talk about visibility and communications and the kind of thing we're doing here today where we're talking about this more, about how critical the housing environment is to school outcomes for kids. It's out there in the ether more than it was before, but we still have a long way to go in making sure that people are really thinking about this in a serious way and then moving to action in a variety of ways around it, which is one of the reasons I so appreciate Linda having, you know, pushed on this for so long. You know, and things like this event, and I think the tech companies can play a huge role in talking about this in the context of the many conversations they're having about how they're going to get more underrepresented young people into the fields and working in their companies, where they're getting more students of color who are actually qualified and really talented coming into the workforce in the Silicon Valley. And we have an incredible pipeline of young people with a ton of potential living in these housing environments who need additional support. So I think the visibility is really, you know, important. And then I'll put the obvious one out there. I think resources coming into support programs in housing for young people in particular around the fields that they have expertise in, science, technology, engineering, and math, is an obvious one.
Deborah?
Technology-based project.
We'll give you something.
Y'all ought to remember me about the technology disaster I am. Technology-based, project-based learning. That one of the key things that we know in terms of getting different sectors to talk together and young people to learn is that don't just talk about the needing technology, get engaged in problem solving together. Project-based learning inside of school is as important.
Deborah,
in getting...
How can tech companies help with project-based learning?
So there are incredible new resources for teachers to use online for technology. Young people with the social media, there are just lots of ways to pull it together.
Technology companies can help support that work?
Hugely, yeah. Increasing access, innovation, listening to young people around innovating, Common Core. It engages critical thinking in a way that is just transformative. It connects the kids from down here in Silicon Valley across the globe. So it's a whole conversation, but technology-based, project-based learning can really do so much to really reinvigorate curriculum and connection.
Great
and
point.
Between sectors.
Great.
So I'm going to say that at the 10,000 foot level, and I know a lot of the folks in technology here are members of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, you know, I think you have to say that housing matters. I think you have to say that you care about housing and that you need to say that at very loud levels all over the country, not just in California, but in other places where many of these companies work because they're global. So I think saying housing matters, it would be an odd thing for most of the folks to hear at the California legislature from companies, and I think they're hearing it more frequently now, but the leadership group has really been at the forefront of that. So that's one. And then secondly, I mean, I think the tech companies should think about what would it take for every one of you to adopt a housing development and experiment with this. Mm-hmm. Experiment with bringing together an after-school programmer, some high-tech technology thing. Let's say everybody picks one. Mid-Penn, Eden, all of us, I'm sure we'd be happy to run that experiment with you and figure out, you know, which school are we in and where do we start? And, you know, let's maybe we pick the preschoolers, or but run some experiments and think about what happens if we throw it up and see what sticks. And could we all kind of roll up our sleeves and come up with some solutions?
Great. Sunny?
In Silicon Valley and California, technology employers, technology companies, innovators, and employers have an extraordinary voice. More of a, if you will, a moral authority because of the role in our economy. And so I really think you could drive the conversation about how technology is integrated into all solutions and all strategies, and then focusing on how to tackle that wall of poverty in low-income neighborhoods. That does mean housing matters. Housing is always a linchpin in turning around a neighborhood. Schools are the centerpiece. It is those two things that matter. And if technology companies also said to counties, cities, and schools, we are big taxpayers and we expect you to align your existing efforts, then they truly are the glue. In addition to their investment, they can be the glue money.
That's great. Okay, we don't have much time left. Here's how we're going to use the next 10 minutes. We're going to take all your questions at once, and then you guys will make closing comments. So listen to all the questions. Jonathan, was that a great advice to the technology company? Just give him a hand for that. and we'll start right next to you.
Hi, Laura Lanzanacapo from the Nonprofit Housing Association. Given what we know about the symbiotic beneficial relationship between affordable housing and affordable and healthy housing, as well as schools. How do we really bring that down to the local level, at the city council level? Because day after day, whenever we're fighting for affordable housing tools, the two problems that we hear are traffic and then the school has no capacity. And the hardest one to fight is the school, because affordable housing advocates have already created partnerships with transit advocates. So what do we do at that very local
level?
Great
question. Who's next? But right back there.
Hi, James Arett, with the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley. So the point that Deborah made about this, there are two debates I think that we're having in this advocacy community that I'd like to see kind of stop. One is the debate between building and preservation. How do we stop having that fight? They're both necessary. And secondly, how about let's stop the debate between getting folks into communities of opportunity and building up the communities where people already are. That also is a both and we work with folks at Somos Mayfair, tremendous place-based organization in San Jose that's doing a lot to build up its community. We also represent people at Buena Vista Mobile Home Park in Palo Alto, where the kids have a 0% dropout rate and are getting a world-class education for folks who chose to move there in that community of opportunity. It's both and we need to stop these internecine fights. How do we do that?
Right. Next, right up here. I'll stop the fight between building and preservation. Got it. Right up here. Right up here. And who's next? Right over here. We'll work our way across.
I'm Chris Clark with District 5 United and Eastside passed the bond, but apparently Alum Rock, which is a feeder district to Eastside, did not pass the bond. That's number one, what's happening to those kids. And you talked about subsidized housing. East San Jose, I'm with Park West Neighborhood Association. There's just houses, lots of houses with lots of people that are undocumented probably, et cetera, and don't have this. What about them?
Great question. We'll come back to you, Jonathan. Since you're a host, we'll give you the mic.
I'm going to stay seated because the
okay, go ahead.
Camera's right behind me. I'm Maureen Schilling from Housing Trust Silicon Valley. I love this conversation. I'm so impressed with all of you. I don't want this to stop. There should be hundreds of people in this room. How do we get the word out? How do we make this a grassroots effort? I'd be willing to work on it. I know others would. How do we do this? That is my big question.
Great. We want to run back to Jonathan real quick, or else he's going to cut off the coffee.
Jonathan, don't cut off the coffee before I leave.
Microsoft has a citizenship program that gives away over $1 billion worth of product and cash a year globally. In addition, we have a USpark initiative that touches 300 million youth throughout the world that's really designed to address this opportunity gap. And a couple of the features of that program is that our Office 365 solution, the same solution that's being run by the City of San Jose, counties throughout the state, is free to school districts. If school districts upgrade for their faculty and staff to the next level, then every student in that school district becomes eligible for up to 5 licenses of Office 365. What does that mean? It means a student can download it on their tablet, if they have that, their phone, if they have that, their box at home, if they have that. In addition, somehow the brothers and mothers and other family members somehow find themselves with copies of it. It's part of just many programs that Microsoft, and I know LinkedIn's got several programs, throughout the Valley are engaging. So I would also encourage folks who are wondering about, hey, what's out there, to look. You know, pick your web browser of choice, go, you know, find it, and see what opportunities are out there, because there are a lot of programs that can tap into some of what we're talking about.
Great. We're going to move right along over here.
I'm Sandra Murillo, Housing Trust, Silicon Valley. And first, I'd like to thank Chris Funk for helping my husband and I accept our daughter into Lincoln when she was bullied at Pioneer. So thank you.
You're welcome.
And secondly, I think this conversation needs to go to the local jurisdictions so that they can, and so that we can advocate and they can understand the importance of the marriage between affordable housing and education, and have them redirect some of their federal funding sources, you know, HUD money, into this. HUD is very focused on chronic homelessness right now, but we're leaving these kids behind.
That's right.
And I think we need to start talking to them as well, unfortunately, but.
Great.
Very important.
Last person in the end.
Thank you. Sabrina Parra Garcia, I work for San Jose City Councilmember Magdalena Carrasco. And I wanted to piggyback on something that got said at the beginning and that you brought up as well, which is that we obviously, as somebody who works for a policymaker, we're trying to move this conversation forward. We're trying to bring all of these pieces together, but we are running into these jurisdictional issues. Chris has been great with our office, but not all school districts are the same. And then there's county resources on top of that. So if you guys could address sort of other strategies that could be employed, because I know a lot of people turn to us and say, why aren't you moving things? And we're like, well, because we don't have all the power. So
great. Okay, those are all the questions. Now, you'll get a gold star, an A, if you answer all of them. But let's shoot for an A minus now. If we can give each one of you 1 minute to address some of the questions that have come up. You can pick one. You can kind of synthesize your answer. Who would like to start?
Well, let me just start by saying that I'm someone that is always open to learning, so I've learned a couple things. I'm going to check with my IT director to make sure we have the latest license, because I think we do, but I was not aware of the 5 licenses for each child. And 2, in all honesty, I've learned a lot from just sitting here, so I'm going to be following up with Linda and Jennifer to make sure that if we have housing that they oversee and after school programs that they oversee, how we can link together and make sure things are more efficient and share funding. And then finally, I will also push the East Side Alliance to make sure that all 8 districts on the East Side are open to this type of collaboration.
Thank you. Very succinct.
I just wanted to echo the comment about federal money through HUD and also through the Department of Education. And I think given the context of where our state is and our resource situation, even though it's better, I don't think it's likely we're going to get targeted funding for youth programs and housing from the state. I think it's possible at the federal level. In the past, we've seen initiatives where federal agencies have collaborated. There was an initiative that HUD and Health and Human Services and Education collaborated on co-funding around community development strategies a number of years ago. I think sometimes those initiatives, and I'm going to put Promise Neighborhoods in that category too, can get overly complex and very difficult for people to tackle. I think it needs to be simpler. I think we could advocate for something that was just really focused on the link between housing and schools, and it could be jointly funded, and we're interested in thinking about that. And then I just want to also echo this comment that yes, we need to get out there more and talk about this more. I'd love to see bigger forums and really targeted ones as well, where we're bringing together groups of principals and superintendents, for example, or presenting at their conferences where they gather and talking about this there and getting really concrete on sharing strategies.
Great. Thank you. Deborah?
I want to thank you. This has been great. I think one thing I'm thinking is that this problem is decades old. This conversation is really new and needs to keep deepening. The unintended consequences of the disconnect are known by individual kids and families and superintendents, you know, and housers individually. But making those visible, making the unintended consequences of kids failing in school, of not succeeding and getting their access to what they deserve visible so that it's compelling for everyone to come to the table is critical. Everybody has, this is a very hard intersection. There are intractable issues that are very hard to get folks together around. When you build on success, like what you're talking about here, it's around positive things. It's not around the problem, right? So structuring partnerships around successful, and if you don't have it, create a project for folks to do together, right? Not solving the world, but solving something very tangible and tactical, and then it hits a multiplier effect. And get kids involved. They're awesome. They are exponentially getting adults involved in engagement. So that's my last word. Get all ages involved in the conversation. They're our best champions for this connection.
Linda?
So, there's too many questions for me to answer them succinctly. So I'm going to just go to the what next, because I do think actually that's really why I did it. Because I think the what next is really what we should all be talking about. And, you know, I see the Silicon Valley Foundation is in the back of the room, and Microsoft is here, and Mohammed is here with the Education Foundation. And, you know, there's a lot of folks that are really doing these things separately. And when Jennifer and I got started, our first stop was back at the Cal Foundation and then with the San Francisco Foundation to say, you know what, maybe we should do something bigger where we all talk together and that we have more than one superintendent in the room. But at the end of the day, I think we're going to experiment. At Eden, you know, we tried it once with digital connectors and we had 800 kids in it, right? I think that some of this is bringing together folks, talking about what are you doing where? How do we get our universities involved? Because we have Cal, we have Stanford, we have Santa Clara. And what do we do to create some real solutions? How do we do it? Maybe we pick one community room in one location and we try some stuff out, but I feel like we should have a bigger conversation. We are podcasting this event. It will be released for all of you to broadcast to all of your friends. But I would just invite you to come back for another conversation and make a list of the five people you think you should bring to it. Because I feel like that's how Jennifer and I, that's where we started. We just had a conversation. And when you asked me what my outcome would be, it's like, well, I would like this to be the first step in progress. Because I, like you, am very frustrated. School districts here, school board, different people, city council, and nobody really works together. And I'm tired of being the excuse for why, you know, the school system says, oh, we don't want any more affordable housing because it's going to impact our schools. Well, our affordable housing could actually positively impact the children. So I think we need to get over that argument and move forward.
Great point.
It's always about leadership. And so if you really wanted to start this, you get the county, the city, the schools for a given neighborhood, and you focus on that neighborhood with accountability for how are the children and their parents doing, and then find the project you're going to work on. It can be linking schools and housing, but that's the key. And when I say leadership, it does require the public sector, but also the residents in that neighborhood and all of the stakeholders, the heads of the organizations. That's the best way I know how to actually break through the silos and actually get something going.
Great, thank you. We're sorry we're 3 minutes over, but please join me in thanking the panelists. This conversation is not over.
For the latest news from Eden Housing, follow us on Twitter and Facebook. To download prior episodes and to receive each new show automatically, subscribe for free in iTunes on your PC or the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. To learn more, visit us at edenhousing.org.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.